This week, Israel's war with Hamas heads to the International Court of Justice after South Africa filed a case of genocide against the Jewish state. Israel says it will defend itself at the World Court. And as the two sides prepare for a legal showdown in The Hague, we'll look at the possible fallout, the fault lines, and what's at stake for Israel and South Africa. Straight Talk Africa starts now.
Hello there and welcome to Straight Talk Africa. We're coming to you from VOA's headquarters in Washington. I'm Heidi Adams. Israel's war with Hamas begins to play out this week on another front, more than 2,000 miles away, at the International Court of Justice in The Hague. South Africa has filed a lawsuit at the United Nations top court accusing Israel of committing genocide in Gaza. Israel says the legal action amounts to anti-Semitism and is vowing to defend itself to the fullest in the proceedings. South Africa's ruling African National Congress has long backed the Palestinian cause for statehood, for decades, in fact, likening the plight of Palestinians to that of the country's black majority under apartheid. It's a comparison Israel vehemently rejects. As relations between South Africa and Israel continue to fracture, the International Court of Justice is preparing for a landmark legal battle between the two countries. David Doyle from Reuters explains.
A South African case accusing Israel of genocide in the Gaza war heads to the International Court of Justice for hearings this week.
Please be seated.
So what's it about? And what happens next? The ICJ, also known as the World Court, is the highest United Nations legal body. It should not be confused with the International Criminal Court, also in The Hague, which handles war crimes cases against individuals. The ICJ deals with disputes between states. That's often about borders, but increasingly includes cases by countries accusing others of breaking UN treaty obligations. Gambia, for example, brought an ongoing genocide case against Myanmar in 2019 over the latter's treatment of the Rohingya minority group. South Africa's 84-page filing accuses Israel of committing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. It's doing this, South Africa claims, by killing them, causing serious mental and bodily harm, and by creating conditions on life, quote, calculated to bring about their physical destruction. South Africa, which has a long history of supporting the Palestinian cause, also alleges that Israel has failed to curb incitement to genocide by its own officials in violation of the Genocide Convention. Israel has called the claim baseless and said it will present its case in court. A government spokesman accused South Africa of an absurd blood libel. Israel began its bombardment of Gaza following Hamas's October 7th cross-border rampage, in which, according to Israeli officials, 1,200 people were killed. The Israeli military says it tries to avoid harm to civilians, but blames Hamas for embedding fighters within residential areas, something the group denies. Palestinian health officials say the Israeli offensive has so far killed more than 23,000 Palestinians in Gaza. The ICJ hearing on January the 11th and 12th will deal with a request by South Africa for provisional measures, including ordering Israel to suspend its military campaign in Gaza. Such measures are designed to prevent dispute from getting worse, while the court looks at the full case. The ICJ's rulings are final and without appeal, but it has no way of enforcing them. However, a ruling against Israel could hurt its international reputation and set a legal precedent. There are several hoops to jump through before a full case could be heard. The ICJ needs to find that it has prima facie jurisdiction, after which Israel would get another chance to argue the court has no grounds to look at South Africa's claim. It is not unusual for several years to pass between the initial claim and the actual hearing of the case on its merits.
So how have South Africans responded to their government's case against Israel, especially in a crucial election year? Let's go now to Ziyanda Ngcobo. She's a correspondent with VOA affiliate station in South Africa, Newsroom Africa. She is in Johannesburg and joins me now. Ziyanda, great to see you. I want to start right, get right to the point here. How have South Africans in general reacted to their government's legal action against Israel?
Good day to you, Heidi, and your viewers. And I think, you know, generally speaking, South Africans, this issue has actually polarized the country to a large extent because it brings up old memories of the past. As you've already mentioned in your intro, that our very own government, in particular South African president just today, Cyril Ramaphosa, talking about how the conditions of the Palestinian people resembles the black majority during the apartheid regime. And of course, it's no secret that the Israel and the U.S. And Israel and the apartheid regime had a special relationship. But however, there is also another layer where there are some South African Jewish people who are actually rejecting some of the remarks that have been made by the South African Jewish Board of Deputies, which has basically been echoing the sentiments of the Israeli government. Now, some of these South African Jews are saying that they do not subscribe to the comments of this Jewish Board of Deputies, that they don't represent their views, and that actually they are propagating Zionism. And so to that extent, there are a few and there are pockets of you know, South African Jews who are condemning what is currently taking place in Gaza. But generally speaking, it has become quite a contentious issue, not just amongst the South African populace, but even within you know, our parliament, and especially amongst the political parties and how they handle you know, their tone and their language regarding this matter.
Now, this is a war that is taking place thousands of kilometers away from South Africa itself. This is an election year, and there are issues at home that do affect ordinary South Africans. I mean, given the timing here, does the South African government's actions in the global arena, does it help or hurt their standing and popularity amongst voters, especially that of the ANC ruling party amongst voters? Does it help them or hurt them in this election year?
Well, it's not really easy to say at this point, but, you know, one can, you know, say that the ANC has been consistent in its stance for solidarity with the people of Palestine. But what I can mention is that when you look at the political parties such as the official opposition in the state of the Western Cape, where they are running that particular state, it has become a contentious issue in the sense that they cater for a very different constituency. They cater they're targeting rather both, you know, the Jewish community as well as, you know, the Muslim community in the Western Cape. And so how the Democratic Alliance has managed this matter has come under the spotlight just yesterday. In fact, a community in the city of Cape Town, the authorities, they actually painted over a building, a wall that had a flag of a Palestinian flag. And that has caused much debate. And so the ANC may not necessarily be hurt by this because of how it's actually been consistent in its tone, but the ANC-led government has been hailed by and large for actually, you know, taking the right stance, according to those who support them, of course, being on the right side of history. And in fact, today, over 1,000 international organizations are also throwing their weight behind South Africa's legal challenge that, of course, will be heard in the International Court of Justice tomorrow.
Well, Ziyanda Ngcobo in Johannesburg for us. Ziyanda, many thanks. We're going to take a short break here. And when we come back, what is at stake at the International Court of Justice as it prepares for a high-stakes legal showdown between South Africa and Israel? My guests are standing by. We will be back in a moment.
In times of change, when the world seems uncertain, and what we hear doesn't reflect what we see, we seek the truth. When we are told only part of the story, we lose trust. In moments of crisis, our dreams, hopes, and wishes for a better tomorrow depend on a free press. At Voice of America, we bring you the stories that people take risks to see. We connect the world and unite it with truth. At Voice of America, we show you the whole picture.
According to a UNICEF report, despite progress, adolescent girls continue to bear the brunt of the HIV infections, with 71% of new cases among girls aged 10 to 19 reaching a crisis level in Eastern and Southern Africa. On the next edition of Our Voices, we take a closer look at the surge of HIV and AIDS among young teen girls and examine what is being done to address the setback. Join the conversation each week right here on Our Voices.
You're watching VOA's Red Carpet. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Thank you so much for joining us each week right here on Red Carpet. We bring you the latest in...
agree with the complaints lodged by South Africa with the ICJ.
I think South Africa raising a concern to the international court is quite a big thing, because I feel like it's South Africa that's kind of raising the question that it is genocide.
I think that it is shameful and it's an embarrassment for the South African government to be taking Israel to the court, so to speak, of justice.
I think we haven't really seen a lot of countries take as bold a stand against the genocide that's happening in Palestine. And, you know, Palestine was supportive of anti-apartheid efforts in South Africa.
South Africa experienced apartheid, the cruel, difficult, dark past of apartheid. And who are they taking to the court of justice, international court? Taking Israel. Israel's the only democracy in the Middle East. Do you see the contradiction in terms?
South Africa is definitely in the right for trying to raise concern about possible genocide happening in a modern day time.
The claims themselves are completely ludicrous. Genocide was what happened to the Jewish people during the Holocaust, which was attempted to happen to the Jewish people during the Holocaust.
We can't just sit back and watch, you know, the destruction of an entire people and their land happen. So I think this is a step in the right direction.
Welcome back. We're discussing a landmark case at the International Court of Justice in The Hague, where South Africa has filed a lawsuit accusing Israel of genocide in its war with Hamas. Israel vows to defend itself at the UN's top court and accuses South Africa's government of anti-Semitism. So what's behind the motive of South Africa's legal action against Israel, and what is at stake for Israel as well as for South Africa in this legal showdown in The Hague? My guests this week are Sanusha Naidoo. She's a foreign policy analyst and a senior research associate at the Institute for Global Dialogue. She joins us from Cape Town, South Africa. Joining us from Lubbock in the U.S. state of Texas is Jeffrey Korn. He's a national security law professor and a fellow at the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs. And also with us is Francis Boyle. He's a human rights lawyer and a professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law. He joins us from Champaign. Ladies and gentlemen, a warm welcome to Straight Talk Africa, or should I say lady and gentlemen. Sanusha, I actually do want to start with you and pick up from my question here that I had with the South African reporter earlier. It is an election here in South Africa. I think elections are just over 3 months away. Is this legal challenge at the ICJ a savvy political move in an election year on the part of the ruling ANC, or a risky one?
Good day, Heidi, and good day to my colleagues on the panel. I think it's a very interesting one, because we did have a previous test of not necessarily the ICJ application that South Africa made in late December, but rather how South Africa and the ruling party was perceived on the Ukraine issue and where it stood on the Ukraine issue. And that became quite an interesting domestication of an issue on foreign policy, where we never really had this before in terms of election manifestos on foreign policy and how it was becoming a key component of political party spectrum. And so now I think it's interesting because, as Ziyanda said earlier in the interview, it's really a fractious issue, because in the election manifestos up to now, foreign policy has played a secondary role. With the current status quo and what we're seeing happen in terms of international law and where South Africa now is positioning itself, particularly the ANC, in terms of this landmark application it's made and the hearings that we'll see over the next 2 days, I think it raises the question around where political parties are finding themselves. And just today, a few of the political parties, newer parties, and of course the older parties that have been in the spectrum for a while, have had very, very differential views about their positioning on this case and whether or not they see the South African government utilizing this for its own domestication of an election year, trying to put it up. But I think it would have some kind of impact, particularly as Ziyanda mentioned, in the Western Cape, where the opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, rules the province. And it creates a lot of tension because you have the largest Muslim majority of people of Malay descent that are in the Western Cape. And so it's going to be a contentious one for the DA, for example. And how they navigate it is going to be important, because the ANC has always aligned with the Palestinian issue in that way. And it has utilized that for different constituencies within the political landscape of South Africa.
Francis Boyle, the U.S. and Israel have both said that South Africa's case is meritless. You have some important history and experience with the International Court of Justice, and particularly on the issue of genocide. What do you make of the merits of South Africa's case?
Yes, I single-handedly won two massive, overwhelming orders from the International Court of Justice for the Republic of Bosnia-Herzegovina against Yugoslavia to cease and desist from committing all acts of genocide. This was the first time ever that any lawyer or government had won two such orders from the World Court since it was founded in 1921. I also won an Article 74, Paragraph 4 order from the President of the Court. Three orders on genocide in under six months. I have reviewed the application and request for provisional measures of protection, and based on my knowledge, judgment, and experience, I believe South Africa will win an order against Israel to cease and desist from committing all acts of genocide against the Palestinians. Indeed, South Africa has already won here by getting the hearings from the World Court that will open tomorrow.
Jeffrey Korn, I'd like to bring you in here. What is the likely defense that Israel will mount here?
Well, I think the first line of defense is to point out to the court that the application, the 84 application, is full of selective facts and inferences. There is much more to this story that has not been included in that application, to include the inherent nature of engaging in armed hostilities against an enemy that uses the civilian population as cover in the best analysis, and in the worst analysis actually seeks to inflict civilian casualties because it contributes to their strategic information campaign. And you asked the question early on, what is the significance of this? And in a sense, Professor Boyle is correct. You can't put this toothpaste back in the tube. One of the people on the street that you showed the interview of said, I think it was appropriate for South Africa to file the case against the Israeli genocide. That comment actually indicates a conclusion of a fact that's in significant debate. Genocide requires compelling proof of intent to destroy in whole or in part a population. And I don't think when the court looks at the actual facts related to this conflict, the efforts the Israelis have made to try and mitigate the risk to the civilians, while Hamas has made every effort to exacerbate risk to civilians, that the court is going to conclude that the circumstances of the actual operation align with the accusation of an intent to destroy the Palestinian population.
Sanusha, to that point, is there a genuine debate in South Africa around what is going on in the Middle East right now? And how does it strike you that other African countries are not going to the same length that the South African government is going to, that they're not openly coming out and backing South Africa's legal challenge at the ICJ?
Well, to answer your question about the debate, yes, you do have the Palestinian Solidarity Forum, and they have many different iterations that are taking place. So there's a constant advocacy that's happening within the South African landscape around the Palestinian issue, the issue around the BDS, the issue around what's going on in Gaza, and there's a constant feed into that. Now, whether that manifests and extends to the broader South African public. And I think I want to also just kind of go back to the three people that were interviewed earlier, and just to say that, you know, it's a very brave, broad spectrum to draw any kind of conclusion around how the South African public and the domestic environment is being informed. I think you do have these debates happening. But again, what I want to also emphasize here is that it is happening within particular spectrums, within particular contexts, and within particular spaces. But I don't think that in the broader context of things, people have completely checked out of this. There still is a sense of public outrage in South Africa when you see what's going on in Palestine, Gaza. But I think, again, as Zyanda said, you know, the there are different constituencies within the South African landscape linked also to political parties who have taken a particular stance, and they also have been not necessarily supporting the South African application or showing a support around the kind of humanitarian crisis and the human rights issue that's unfolding, but not necessarily seeing this application in the way that is being viewed in the more broader sense of the South African government. To come back to the other point that you raised, I think it's also very important to bear in mind that in South Africa, there's a serious issue around this election, and that's a domestication of our political landscape. So it's the internal dynamics of governance and challenges and transparency and questions around where we're going after 2024, after the next election, and how that will inform people's public opinion. So I think you've got this juxtaposition between the international on the one hand and the domestic on the other.
Francis, can any country file a complaint against another country? I mean, can you just help us understand how this works? Because we don't often hear about the ICJ. And also tell us who's going to fit the bill for South Africa's legal team. Will this come down to South African taxpayers?
Well, first, I wanted to reply to Professor Korn's point. I single-handedly, all by myself, won those two orders of provisional measures of protection for Bosnia that were massive, overwhelming in favor of Bosnia against Yugoslavia. Now, in the case of South Africa, they have a high-powered international legal team there who have produced a work product, an application and request for provisional measures of protection that is far superior to what I did myself, single-handedly working free of charge for Bosnia and Herzegovina and eating my own expenses. So if I could win two orders with my work product, South Africa is certainly going to win their order against Israel to cease and desist from committing all acts of genocide against the Palestinians.
And can you answer my earlier question about who pays for this crack legal team?
That would be the government of South Africa. I worked free of charge for the Bosnians. They couldn't pay me. They had nobody. So I worked free of charge, pro bono publico, and I ate my own expenses. It cost me...
But there is a chance that the South African taxpayer would have to foot this bill.
Well, yes, the South African government would be part of their budget, sure.
Jeffrey, given that Israel has said it will mount its defense at the ICJ. Does that mean that Israel will recognize and even obey any outcome or decision made by that court, even if it doesn't go Israel's way?
I mean, I think that's pure speculation at this point. The significance of an adverse judgment towards Israel from the ICJ would be profound. And I think the Israeli government knows that. And they're going to do all they can to present the court with a full record of facts. And in response to my colleague, Professor Boyle, who I have tremendous respect for, the best lawyers in the world cannot change facts. And the facts related to this conflict are objective. Those facts indicate you have one party to the conflict that since inception has made a good faith effort to respect the laws and customs of war against an enemy that has no respect for those laws and is deliberately putting civilians at risk. And even if you look at the numbers, and this is not in any way trying to devalue the tragedy of the loss of life, but if we look at the number of 23,000, you'll note that Hamas never includes in that number how many of them were enemy fighters. The Israelis estimate they've killed approximately 8,000 enemy fighters to this point. That's about a 1-to-2 ratio of enemy fighter to civilian in the most densely populated and urban combat environment imaginable. There are very few conflicts where you've had that low of a ratio, and that's out of a population of 2 million people. So I just think that objectively, the facts and circumstances that the conduct of hostilities being conducted by Israel are intended to destroy the Palestinian population is not credible. And when the court sees the rest of these facts and circumstances, including the facts related to the rules of war and which side is complying and which side is violating, it's a very different picture. And the best lawyers in the world cannot change the facts on the ground.
Francis, I want to give you a chance to respond to that and also to answer this question for me. There is great concern that Israel's war on Hamas will, broaden, and some might argue to an extent it already has. How would that affect this case and vice versa? If this conflict goes beyond Gaza while this case is ongoing at the ICJ and while that war could potentially become more about the West Bank and Lebanon and Iran, how does that affect this case at the ICJ?
Brett, I wanted to respond to Professor Korn's point about the numbers. In the final judgment on the merits in 2007, the International Court of Justice ruled that even 7,000 dead Bosnian Muslims at Srebrenica were enough to constitute genocide. Well, even...
Yes,
excuse me, I did not interrupt you. Even the Professor Korn admitted that 23,000 Palestinians now are dead. That's triple the number of Srebrenica. Second, acting on behalf of my clients, the mothers of Srebrenica and Padrina, I convinced the prosecutor for the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia to indict my adversary, Slobodan Milosevic, the president of Yugoslavia, for almost every crime in the ICTY statute, including two counts of genocide, one for genocide in Bosnia in general, and the second for genocide at Srebrenica. He was put on trial at The Hague. At the close of the prosecution's case, he made a motion to dismiss all charges. The tribunal rejected that motion and ruled that the prosecution had submitted enough evidence to convict Milosevic, the president of Yugoslavia, of all charges, beyond reasonable doubt, including the two counts of genocide against Bosnia and Srebrenica.
Francis, unfortunately, we have to wrap. Our show's coming to an end, but let's make this deal. I'll invite all of you back. This trial, this case, the hearings are ongoing, and I'll invite all of you back. Thank you so much for being with me, and thank you for always watching and for always joining us. I'll see you next time. Goodbye.